As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I am JJ Bull. I am hosting the podcast this week. So you can switch off now if you would like. Today, I am joined by the magical John McKenzie.
Hello.
Hello, John.
That was my magical.
Yes. And now there's magic in the air, because we are joined also by Ruben Pinder, the new boy in the office.
We're still keeping that going.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not doing the baby thing that Joe did.
That was weird. Hello, how are you?
Fine.
Good.
So today we spoke about Brendan Rodgers. He's been sacked. Did you know that? I know you did, because you talk about it. And then there's also a lot on Graham Potter, because he was also sacked. Lots of sackings coming up. Crystal Palace, Roy Hodgson replaced the sacked Patrick Vieira.
And we're good again.
Yes, Crystal Palace, very good. Yep.
A sack.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, that is good, John. Well done.
Thanks.
Worst chant in football, by the way. But
and we find out where that phrase comes from, getting the sack. That's something we learn. We are educational on this podcast. So you learn about getting the sack. And then we do a bit on Manchester City versus Liverpool and look at the gap that's emerged between those two teams, because they both used to be very good. And now only one is. Why? And then we asked, would you allow sentient crows into a football match if they had a ticket? Aren't crows sentient? They are sentient. They're just not... that they're alive crows. This is what producer Steve's written, you see here. I think what he means is if it's... we're anthropomorphizing the crow as though it were a human and could enter a stadium.
Language.
Yeah. Would they? Could you let animals into stadiums if they're not with an owner, but they were presenting themselves as humans?
Sentient means able to perceive or feel things. So I'm guessing if you weren't sentient, you wouldn't want to go to the football because it'd be a waste of time.
Or maybe you can't feel things and you want to go to football to see if you can, and that's the reason what it is.
That's just us.
Do crows have feelings? Find out later. The top four race featuring Brighton and Brentford, pacey Newcastle, and a stuttering Manchester United. I should have done it like this, stuttering Manchester United, like The Who would have done. Roger Daltrey would have done that. Although Pete Townsend said that he wrote that stuttering bit.
Did he?
Daltrey says it was him. These are all facts about The Who. And then we have a very quick tour to Naples and Munich. And that's what we do. And if you'd like to learn even more about football from around the globe, like a real pro, someone like John McKenzie, you can read The Athletic. And if you go to theathletic.com/TIFO, what happens, John?
You can find lots of interesting information. For example, our good friend Dr. Mark Carey is at it again, I'm afraid to say. But he's just put out a piece on why... Well, I guess in the Premier League...
It sounds like you're implying he's done something nefarious.
He's done something nefarious. Yeah. He has written a piece about back post scoring, which is something we made a video about with Mark Carey on T4IRL. So do check that out as well.
Yes, please do. That would be lovely. You can check out... if you're watching this on the YouTube, then you already know where you are. But if you just listen to us, go visit T4IRL on the YouTube. That'd be very useful. We'd like that, wouldn't we, Ruben?
We would indeed. More numbers, please.
More numbers?
Yeah.
Is that all you think about?
Yeah.
What else do you think about?
Nothing, just numbers.
Sharks?
No, not.
When
big,
was the last time
sharks.
You thought about sharks?
Probably when I was watching, is it Step Brothers? When they're like, not allowed to watch the TV, and they're like, but it's Shark Week. probably that.
Do you know, I was at Brighton this weekend. I went to a stag do, and I've never been to Brighton before, so I took myself off to have a walk along the beach. I was walking along the beach, and there was a headless shark on the floor, and I was like, ah, that's a shark. And I walked past it, and I was like, ah, it doesn't have a head. And yeah, so I thought about sharks on Saturday.
How big was it?
It was about this big. It wasn't a big one. But
where had its head gone?
I don't know. I presume it had been eaten by something, then decided they didn't like the taste of
a hungry, hungry
shark.
Seagull.
Yeah. If you know where the shark's head is, write to us at thesharkhead@tifo.com.
That's right.
Do we have that email address?
It just might sound going to send us a shark head now. I don't like where this is going.
Yeah, well, anyway. It's got to be somewhere. Hmm. Unless someone's eaten it. You ever think about this, right? So if you eat something, it's gone and it's inside you. It's gone now. So like you think of it. Think of a loaf of bread, right? Or a baguette. Baguette of bread. Now, if you eat the baguette, where does it go? It's just in you.
Do you know when I was...
Did you do biology at school?
Do you know... When I was young, I was in France for...
Look
France.
How heavy it is! And then it was gone.
I was in France for France 98. And we were in Paris, and I didn't really know what was going on because I was much younger back then. But I have an abiding memory of England fans walking past us and a guy seeing a baguette that had been abandoned on the floor, picking it up and going, un baguette, un baguette, un baguette. That was a very formative moment for me.
It's not quite the... where was he from? Was it an Irish fan on French TV? Like they were doing a news report and the guy just peered behind the news guy and just went, je suis un baguette, and walked off. Remember?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It was class.
Like, if you drink a whole 2 liters of Coca-Cola or something like that.
It's inside you, yeah.
How does it make you as heavy as the cola?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
And then you break it down and you flush it out and you go again, in the famous words of Stephen Gerrard.
So anyway, that's some of the things we've talked about, the nonsense now. And now what we can do instead is leave you in the cool hands and warm embrace of...
A headless shark.
A headless shark. Sackings. Let's start with the latest sackings in the Premier League this season. We've now had 12 sackings. 12 sacks over the heads of men in the Premier League. A record. Did you know that? Graham Potter has been put in a sack. It felt like he may have weathered the sacking storm, though, at Chelsea. But a 2-0 defeat at home to Aston Villa was the moment the Todd Bowley Project, that's like definitely a name of a band, decided Graham Potter was no longer their man. Chelsea 0, Aston Villa 2. We've been talking about Potter being sacked basically since he was hired, John. So why do we think it has now actually happened?
Well, I think there's a combination of things, isn't there? It's not, they keep losing games, not looking great, which is never a good sign for a manager, and usually will result in being sacked if you do that enough times. But also, Julian Nagelsmann is now on the menu.
They're going to eat Nagelsmann.
They're going to eat Nagelsmann. When that kind of thing comes up, then you quickly get rid of your coach so he doesn't see what it is that you can do to managers. But it does feel to me as though that's maybe what's precipitated this, that a good manager has come on the market at this point of the season. And I think everyone's probably going to be panicking about who is going to end up getting him. But I think
just that, just you think it's mostly because of that?
It's not mostly because of that. I think there's all of waves, hands, everything else that's happened with Potter. And I think it's a shame. I think the big question with Chelsea is always going to be how much of this was down to Potter and how much was down to the madness of what's happened at Chelsea this season.
Ruben, the big question is how much of this was down to Graham Potter and how much of this was down to the madness of Chelsea?
It's a bit of both, isn't it? It's one of them unanswerable questions where it's easier to sack.
I'm afraid you're going to have to answer it.
60-40 chaos Potter. There you go. But... It's like it's always easier to just change a manager than
Chaos,
you know,
Potter,
just,
of course, one of the least favourite characters in the Harry Potter series.
Chaos Potter.
That's a less good name for a band, I think, Chaos Potter.
Yeah. But he had a massive squad. Like, there were so many bad decisions that weren't his fault, but it as John said, like that they weren't improving. So like there's one thing giving a manager time, which they obviously intended to do, but if you're not seeing little gradual improvements and you are just losing games that you should win and kind of embarrassingly so, then it did become untenable. But there's also the factor that, now I don't know whether this is legit and whether there was this clause, but this is the first time they've dipped into the bottom half of the table, and Chelsea, as reported by the Telegraph, don't have to pay his full severance package, which would have been something like 50 million quid. So those two things could be connected. There could be like a clause where now is the moment to sack him cheaply rather than very expensive, because he brought a whole massive team as well, didn't he, of coaches, and they've all stayed. So
yeah, and then he's helping them out. I can't remember the phrase they used, but he's basically just been like, all right, on you go.
Yeah, the phrase used was that he's been very professional about things.
He seems like a professional man.
I think so, yeah. He seems like a nice guy, and he seems like a...
That was the problem.
Yeah, too nice.
Well, I wonder if it actually is a problem, because whether he doesn't have the air of authority that certain other managers do. He certainly doesn't talk like a... in certain interviews, I wonder whether he doesn't talk like a big manager, because he just accepts that some things, that's just the way it is, which is quite refreshing, but maybe some players need to be talked to a different way. And I wonder, John, because you've coached teams before, what are the difficulties with having 400 players? Because when you're trying to set up a session, right, you adapt it to how many players you've got. So apparently they've had sessions where there's an 11v11 on one pitch and then like a 9v9 or another. And
yeah, I mean, I think it's really tricky, actually. I mean, you say I've coached teams. I coached at a very low level. I coached at university level. But even in those situations at the university level, we would have a squad of about 15 players for a game. And you would drive for, you know, an hour and a half to a game, and you're taking three subs, or four subs, whatever, and you may not use one of them, in which case you're essentially taking someone away from a pretty busy university schedule to justify taking the day off to sit on a cold sideline in a pitch in Loughborough. And those decisions were hard, and people got pissed off in those situations. Now, if you then speculate towards where Graham Potter was, where he's got a squad of about 40 players, all of whom should be starting for Premier League sides, suddenly you have an even bigger problem on your hands, which is you've got a group of players who all expect to play because they are elite players. And so no doubt that was pretty difficult for him.
But is he getting the most out of that squad of players? Like, is what he's done at Chelsea since he's been there, sure enough, all these guys have come in, very difficult to gel a squad like that. I'm sure a lot of people can, you know, feel sympathy for what he had to be able to do. But they were terrible against Villa, weren't they?
Yeah, they were really bad. And there's issues. There's still issues with the squad somehow. Like, they only really have, well, they have like three proper wingers, and they don't really play a system that, I don't know. They don't have a proper number nine. Mudrick is taking a while to adapt. Pulisic's not that good. Sterling's injured. Like, there are lots of these little things. João Félix coming on loan. Is he going to stay? Who knows? And there's like, you know, loads of defenders that never play and all that stuff. But you still think, given the 11s that he was putting out, they should have been performing much better than they were. So, and there was the other thing, like, given just on the note of like the whole managerial aura and, you know, keeping everybody happy, there was that classic old line reported that some of the Chelsea players had to Google who he was when he got appointed.
It's like, that though, yeah.
he's been managing in the Premier League for 3 years. Like, surely you should know that. But maybe that's just more like symbolic of a general, really, this guy attitude from the players, which if they have that from the start, then you're kind of doomed.
Having said that, though, I do feel as though the game that when they came back against Dortmund in the Champions League, I felt as though the players made a really big show of being happy for him that they had done that. And I don't know, I'm also a little bit funny when we start doing like psychological explanations for why a manager has failed, when actually I think, I mean, that obviously comes into it. And I think, you know, maybe if he'd been a high-powered elite manager, as we think of them, it would have gone slightly different. But if you actually look, for me, if you look at the trajectory tactically for what he did, he came in, tried to do the stuff he'd been doing at Brighton, it didn't work. They brought a load of players in January, and then he went back to just playing a really basic 4-2-3-1 style, and that didn't particularly work either. And then they just went back to playing the 3-4-3 that they'd played mainly under Thomas Tuchel. And if we go back to Tuchel, with the exception of the Champions League, which I realise is probably a stupid thing to say, because a Champions League trophy is obviously important, but you never got the impression that Tuchel's Chelsea tenure was like super effective and productive. And I feel as though the problems that Thomas Tuchel had, and he tried to solve them and eventually ended up just using that 3-4-3 system, is where Graham Potter ended up at. He was sort of like, well, as you said, like, I don't have the ability to be that flexible here. We've just got to go back to playing this back three with wing backs and yeah, like you say, maybe issues with finishing, which we can, I'm sure we'll go on to talk about, because I think that's an interesting aspect of Graham Potter's clubs anyway. But it just felt to me a little bit like the problems with Chelsea are endemic to Chelsea, and we've seen the same problems with the last manager and this manager. Maybe bringing in a new manager will change things up, but for me, a lot of them come down to, as we said, personnel, the fact that Todd Bowley's basically ripped everything out of the club, and there seems to be, you know, everything, there seems to be a level of madness there, but also the fact that the squad just doesn't seem that functional. You can't really come in and getting in a super tactical coach is all well and good, but if you don't have the pieces that you need to be able to be flexible, then it doesn't really add to anything.
I think if you asked 10 people to name their, on paper, like their best Chelsea 11, they'd probably all come up with a slightly different team, because there's just so many different players there.
Yeah, mine would look totally different to what Potter's been playing.
Yeah, what would you change?
Well, first of all, I'd try and get Mudryk like to his right position on the far left, and you want to get Felix into positions where he can do a lot more with the ball. But that missing number nine is huge, because you can't pin defenders back. You've not got someone in the box to aim for. That is, like, the squad's good, but he is missing key bits and pieces. But then that said, the team against Villa is a back three, and two of the back three are fullbacks. Reece James is what, like, the best right wing back in the world, I would say. And then you've got Kukurea, who is the opposite.
Kukurea is so mid, as the kids would say. He's just so bang average. And he cost like £60 million, didn't he?
Yeah.
That was bad.
Well, do you think Graham Potter's reputation has been damaged by his time at Chelsea?
Yeah, I think so. I think... I don't want to sound as though we're just sort of apologising for Graham Potter, because I think there are things that have been done badly by him. And this isn't by any stretch of the imagination us saying, oh, you know, it's just the club and he had no chance of making things better. But there's been a lot of conversations, I think, this weekend about underperforming expected goals, because Graham Potter's teams always seem to underperform expected goals. And there's people out there making explanations for why this might be the case, particularly in terms of the way that Chelsea are trying to attack. But again, to bring it to Tuchel, I feel as though Tuchel have the same problems. I think both of those managers are really good at doing all of the build up from the back, move the ball down the field, get it to the final third. But I think they're both so ponderous in their build up that you end up with giving opposition teams plenty of time to structure their defences in the box for those moments. And I feel as though we saw that a little bit with Tuchel, we saw that a little bit with Potter. And I think I would have liked to have seen him try to identify that problem and change it. So yeah, maybe my criticism of Potter would be tactically would be that, but in terms of going forward, I think he'll probably get a better job than people think. Next.
But where do you think he'll go though?
He could very easily end up at Tottenham, right?
Could be Spurs, yeah. Leicester, maybe, yeah.
I think he's got enough credit in the bank to be able to get like another Premier League job, not an elite job, but I also think that he would probably be okay going somewhere on the continent. He's already got the experience of managing in another country. And
does he speak any other languages?
I don't know.
Probably.
He was in Sweden, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Likely to have spoken English most of the time now. I wouldn't mind him at Palace. There'll be a vacancy there.
You just got Roy.
I wouldn't mind him at Leeds.
Yeah, short-term contract.
I wouldn't mind him at Leeds either, to be honest.
But the XG thing, like where his teams always underperform their XG and can't finish, at Brighton it was like, oh, well, they've got Neo Mopai up front, so that's why. But now it's like, they also, as we've said, Chelsea don't have a prolific clinical number nine. But is it more of an issue than, like, because were we excusing it at Brighton? And now it's like, or maybe his teams actually can't finish. Because as you alluded to, the defensive team can, like, park their team in their box too quickly because they're too ponderous. And then the chances, while they have high XG value because they're, like, close to the goal, in a very crowded area, which makes them less likely to go in.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That makes sense.
I'm pretty sure they were overperforming their expected goals at the beginning of this season before he moved on to Chelsea. I don't know if, was he playing Evan Ferguson back then? I don't know if he was starting him at that point. But
I mean, I'm not sure, but he feels like a De Zerbi.
Yeah, he does a bit.
Popped out of nowhere.
I guess Matoma was being played fairly early on as well, right? But I'd have to dig into that. But I mean, I think there's always interesting arguments to be made about why you might be consistently underperforming your expected goals. I don't think a lot of people have done the actual legwork required to show why that might be the case. So there's been some interesting threads made over on Twitter this weekend trying to explain why that might be from a tactical point of view. But I think what I would want to see is a little bit more examination of the numbers behind that to see whether or not it is just Because, I mean, he's got about 4 or 5 seasons data now where his teams have consistently massively underperformed their expected goals. I think Chelsea this season are pushing 8 goals below where they'd be expected to be. So there's clearly something that's going on there.
There's also this strange factor, which is probably quite harsh to judge Potter for this because he was doing brilliantly with Brighton. Like, objectively, he did very well there. Yes. But they've got even better since he left when De Zerbi came in.
That often happens, doesn't it? They can build off the back of someone else's ideas, and then you add a bit more. Maybe De Zerbi's done that.
I suppose it should be more praise for him than criticism of Potter.
I don't know. Maybe it's a bit of both. I mean, one of the things, like, because you've both said you'd have him at your club, I mean, I think we all agree that he could definitely go to somewhere decent, just maybe not. Like, Chelsea's a bit of a wild one just now, and he probably wouldn't think he'd be on the same level as Jurgen Klopp or Guardiola. He's not that sort of level, but very few people in the entire world are. But one of the places he could definitely go would be Leicester, who now also don't have a manager because they put him in the sack. they now live together in the sack. Crystal Palace
sack with all of those.
The winner gets a Spurs job. Put them in a sack race.
Yes, they have to eat each other to escape the sack.
Oh, they're in the same sack.
Yeah, it's a dog eat dog world or a manager eat manager world. Down, that was exactly what happened down at Selhurst Park.
Eagles.
Crystal Palace 2, Leicester 1. Now, that was Brendan Rodgers' last game as Leicester City manager because, as we said, we put him in the sack afterwards. But Ruben, you were there. Now, we'll talk about Palace in a second. But what did you make of Leicester?
They are inexplicably terrible. A former colleague of mine, Leicester fan, has been asking for Rodgers to be sacked for about a year. Mm. And I never really got it, like, why they were so bad, because, like, he's a fairly accomplished manager. They've got some decent players in that squad. Ricardo Pereira came off the bench. Don't know why he doesn't start. But, you know, there's talent in the squad. But, they were just so passive. Like, really, they let us have something like 20 shots in the first half, and then we ended up with 31 in the whole game, which is more than we had in the previous 4 games combined.
Where were the shots from? Is it from close range or are they shooting from... Because I saw that stat and I was like, where are they shooting
from? They didn't add up to a great number of XG, but... They were kind of edge of the box, just inside the box, few bodies in the way. You know, Decore had a just out like sort of 20 yarder that stunned the keeper's palms. They were like fairly threatening. We weren't just like pinging the ball from wherever. But yeah, they were just inexplicably really, like, passive is the only word I can think of, really. They're just terrible.
Can you improve on that, John? We saw them play against Brentford the other week and they seemed fine-ish. No.
Remind me of the score in that game. 2-2 was it?
1-1.
I mean, you watch Leicester, and I think whenever you've watched Brendan Rodgers' teams in the Premier League, it was just very solid stuff, isn't it? I think for a long time he had this mantra of at home we'll play in like this 4-2-3-1 shape that will be our more attacking shape. And away from home, we'll drop into a 3-4-3 shape, which would be our defensive shape. And that seemed to be about as complex as it got, really. I don't know. I'm pretty low on Brendan Rodgers. Maybe too low. So take what I say with a pinch of salt. But I just looking back over his managerial career, and he feels to me like quite an outdated coach in many respects. And what I mean by that is, it feels as though he was a guy who would be solid. He would coach a solid system, but would rely on individuals within that system to be good.
Do you know what I was thinking? It's similar lines, but it's almost as if, like, when the generation of German managers came along and that became a lot of focus on transition, like, it's all cyclical, right? But when that happened, his methods then were slightly further behind the generation before. Because you look through his career, he was always playing like 4-4-2 and diamonds and stuff, and then at Swansea opened up and made it 4-3-3 and started playing a more expansive kind of game, like the possession game. But I interviewed a load of footballers who played under him to find out what they liked about Rodgers, what was good, and all of them said that his training sessions were amazing. And he came through Chelsea's, I think he was a youth coach, and then I think Mourinho really liked him. But he was he's part of this new wave of managers who did, it's like tactical periodization, everything done with the ball. Yeah. So everything's done that way. And they all loved it, everything he did. I think Joby McEnough said there was not a single session they did twice. It was always new every single time. I think, how'd you come up with all those?
So it's just fun then, more than anything. Right?
Well, and then when that runs out, his Liverpool team was really good and they very nearly won that title.
I feel as though like out of possession systems now have got a lot better. And I feel as though in that kind of world, he maybe doesn't have as many solutions as he did before. But if you look back over the clubs that he's been at, so we talked about Liverpool, and obviously Liverpool weren't the Liverpool of now back then, but they were still one of the bigger the clubs in England. He then goes to Celtic as well, right, where he has a massive financial advantage. And for the most part, Rangers weren't in the league when
yeah,
he was there,
like, well, they had like 69 games unbeaten in a row, which is quite good.
But... Yeah, no, obviously. But I mean, I guess you would expect that from a coach who was,
I think,
half of the old firm in wherever division Rangers were, right? But again, he then comes to Leicester, where they've had all of the successes of the Premier League win and the Champions League performances, where they did quite well. And he's taken Leicester from being a team who were challenging for the Champions League and were very close to getting it, but in his first couple of seasons, to a team who now become a relegation battler. And I think that counts for something, right?
They won an FA
Is that
Cup.
His fault, though? Yeah, he won an FA Cup.
And he probably should have gone after that while his stock was really high. Yeah. Well, not immediately, but like sooner after that.
Ah, but maybe you think you can kick on. And yeah. Like the thing is, this the fall from Leicester going down to this lower half of the table, is it Rodgers' fault? Has he not been backed financially, though? Because they haven't...
That is a big part of it. That is a big part of it.
He has been backed financially until recently.
Yeah, it was
when
summer.
They hit the pandemic, right? Their owners struggled because of the way that his business was structured.
Some of their recent signings have been horrendous, though.
Well, Rob Tanner did a piece in The Athletic, and he says that the club are putting the brakes on spending under Rodgers, having registered a record net outlay of £55 million with five players during the 2021 transfer window. So they needed to bring players in. They brought in Boubacar Soumaré, Patson Daka, Yannick Vestergaard, Ryan Bertrand, and Adamola Lookman. Like, I don't think his signings have ever... Like, he's not really made that many good signings at Leicester.
Lookman? He's a Leicester player.
Well, on loan.
Atalanta at the moment. Oh, they brought him in on loan at the time.
Yeah, I think
right,
so.
Okay.
But
he is still a Leicester player, is he not?
I'm not sure.
Or maybe Atalanta have signed him full time now. But he's also absolutely tearing it up in Serie A right now, Adamola Lookman. Ironically enough, of that list, he looks like the one good signing. Right?
Okay. He went to Leicester on loan. And from Leipzig, and now he's an Atalanta player. Yeah.
So they bought him Atalanta. Yeah.
Well, he's had to replace the spine of that team, if you think about it, because Kasper Schmeichel's gone. Obviously, the team he took over, Wes Morgan, was on the way out, or was already just not there. And then...
Johnny Evans
and Jamie Vardy. So they've missed that whole middle of it. Tielemans is not quite the same player he was before.
Harry Maguire.
Indeed, he's not the same player he was. Is it the coach's fault? Is it that Leicester's players have come down? Basically, are Leicester at the end of this lovely arc they were on? Because they won the league, then they've got pushed in the Champions League, and they've sort of come back down to where maybe they should
end up. The case that like the success that Brendan Rodgers has at Leicester correlates very strongly with the decline and fall of Jamie Vardy? Does that come back to the situation we said before, which is like he'll coach a solid system, but he will rely on individuals in that system if he's not very good at the recruitment side of things, which looking at that list of players suggests might be the case. I don't know how much oversight he has over the
I think people said players, similar things about him at Celtic as well. The players he brought in weren't amazing.
Weren't good enough. Yeah. In which case, you know, we mentioned this the other week, though. It's the meme, isn't it? Like, we're still trying to find the guy who's done this. I mean, at what point does the buck stop with him? If he does have oversight with the recruitment and now the team's bad, well, that's kind of on you, isn't it?
Relying on individual things thing kind of makes sense with his Liverpool team as well, because like they were brilliant, but a lot of their goals were like individual magic from the two strikers. Right?
Suarez was like one of the best players in the world at the time.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And he would score lots of different types of goals, and they weren't like necessarily the same patterns reappearing. It was kind of, so, you know, Gerrard ping the ball to Suarez and hope for the best.
So it's Gerrard, Suarez, Sturridge and Sterling.
And Coutinho's in that team.
Yeah.
Quite a good team to me.
It was a good team, yeah.
Did have Skirtle and Flanagan in the back four, though. So,
well, he still did well. Anyway, so that is Brendan Rodgers then, right? So maybe he's peaked, maybe he's done. Where does he go next? What level is he at now? Do we think Potter's not top four? He's below that. Where do we think Rodgers goes?
I don't know. There's going to be quite a few good managers on the market this summer. I wouldn't surprise
once they empty
me
the sack.
If he ended up, yes, once they have poured them all out onto the market stall, or whatever the wet metaphor we're using now. I don't know where he ends up. A different club in the bottom half of the Premier League.
Exciting.
West Ham, maybe, if they get rid of Moyes.
How about
Palace?
Crystal Palace? Yeah. Because you saw them play. And what hope did he have against the mighty Roy Hodgson?
I know. I mean, look, if you're going to... There are lots of different reasons as to why Rodgers was sacked, as we've just discussed. But the main one being, if you let Jean-Philippe Mateta score against you, you have to go.
Lovely goal. What was the reaction like to Mateta's goal? Because he's not beloved amongst the Crystal Palace fans.
He's a bit of a cult hero because he doesn't score often, but he scores important goals. He scored a brilliant back heel flick against Brighton once. He scored against Millwall in the FA Cup. Those goals are going to make you very popular. And he's got a cool celebration where he like karate kicks the corner flag. And everybody shouts boom, and it's really cringe.
I tell you, Luka Milivojevic isn't doing that, is he? He'd probably fall to pieces if he tried to karate
yeah.
kick
him. Well, thankfully, he's not playing. Yeah, it was honestly magic. Like, the atmosphere was really special. And you mentioned this about Reece Nelson's winner a few weeks ago, the noise. That goal went in, because there was the collective, like, very brief moment of silence as he controlled the ball, and then and then everybody going, go on. Yes, and it's just unbeatable. So yeah, it was great. Palace were genuinely like a completely different team. Eze was back to his best. Who, like, last time I was on, I was saying he's not really had a great season. He was just like unstoppable.
Just needed love.
Yeah, and Roy Hodgson loves him. Like, he actually, because Roy Hodgson had Eze for a season, never got Elise. That was the changeover point.
Right.
But he really loved Eze that first season that he was at the club. So yeah, and like, I've been very down on Palace this season, and I don't mean to tempt fate, but I think everything's going to be totally great forever.
do you feel as though you're safe now? Like, what's that now? You're on 30 points.
Yeah, 30 yeah. points. 2-3 more wins should be fine, like, looking at how bad everybody else is. It's amazing what like one result can do to the whole mood, but it's more the performance than a result. Yeah. We deserve to win that game about 5-0.
Did you go back to 4-4-2 stuff?
No, so he went... When I saw the lineup, I thought it would be 4-4-2... with Eze kind of narrow left mid and Wilf kind of drifting out wide from attack. But it was just a really nice 4-3-3, Doucouré single pivot, Schlupp and Eze number eights. And even Schlupp played well, which hasn't happened in a long time. Elise and Wilf in their best positions. Wilf, unfortunately, had to come off injured.
Did Mateta start up front?
No, he came on for Edouard with about 5-10 minutes to go. And Edouard actually played quite well. Some nice touches.
He was a good player at Celtic. Yeah. He was.
But like, it was just like a team that made sense, a fresh, positive attitude, which is kind of... So we got the new manager bounce that we missed out on last time Hodgson took over. Because when he took over from Frank de Boer in 17-18, he actually lost his first three games and then won his fourth against Chelsea. Which is why, do you remember that press conference when Jose Mourinho was slagging off Frank de Boer saying that he lost 7 games in a row?
Sure.
He didn't. He only lost 4 and the next 3 were Hodgson. But yeah, so it's nice. It's a good time to get a new manager bounce right now.
Well, Steve Hankey has very kindly written or taken stuff from the internet telling us what the meaning of being sacked is. I always wondered why you say you're sacked. And this is what it is. According to the website History Extra, before the Industrial Revolution, when men, women and even children flocked to the factories to make a living. This is written very dramatically. It was far more common for workers to travel from job to job. Labourers would move around on their own, carrying their own tools and supplies. The easiest way to lug their tools around was in a sack, which they would then leave with their employer for safekeeping. Once their services were no longer required, they were literally given their sack before being ordered to pack it up and leave.
We used to be a real country.
Mm. Yeah. So we could just like
Children don't do much work anymore, do they?
I know,
so that's the problem
really
with this country.
Out there.
Children don't do enough.
Yeah,
they're all playing on the Game Boys.
Game Boys.
When they should be lugging.
Give them their sack. That's what I say.
I say they should be carrying tools always.
Yes.
We're gonna have a break now.
Because nobody's got a chimney anymore. It killed the industry.
Yeah.
I say bring back coal fires. That's where everything went wrong, wasn't it?
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and here we go again. Chelsea sacked Graham Potter on Sunday night, leaving the club looking for their third manager of the Todd Boehly era already. So join myself and the Athletic's experts in the field on the Athletic Football Podcast this week as we tell you the inside story of how it all unravelled for Potter and who Chelsea may turn to next. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Oh, we're back from enlisting children to carry tools around the city. Manchester City 4, Liverpool 1. They were absolutely battered in this game, Liverpool. Man City were excellent.
You said the scoreline correctly there, which makes me very happy.
Yeah. Well,
You didn't do the Joe Devine.
Well, I'm not Joe Devine, and he wants us to be ourselves, and so I'll do it.
I'm just glad that he's been given the sack.
I've only been here like a month, so I've been too scared to bring that up, but it really annoys me.
Oh, I really liked it. I think it's funny. Well, I think it all started because Joe, to annoy Seb, would just read out literally what Seb says, you see, and that's why it's funny. In the same way that I will read literally what Steve says, because then it becomes a... I think, like, he's done this. This is really good, actually. Liverpool looked like they might put a spanner in the works for Man City, but that did not last. So what happened in this game then, right? So Jota came back. That's useful for Liverpool. But what happened in this game, John?
I always find these games really interesting because I feel like whenever Man City play Liverpool, they always sort of end up playing very similar style of football to each other. And usually that can result in kind of really stolid 1-1 draws or whatever. But in this one, obviously that wasn't the case. But yeah, it felt to me that both teams were sort of building up in the same way. Both teams were pressing in the same way. So they both used a sort of 4-4-2 out of possession approach. But the problem was that Liverpool got quite narrow in their forward press, and Man City were able to just build up through them. There was lots of people talking about how there were similarities between how Man City were building up and what Roberto De Zerbi is doing. So people asking whether or not Pep is being influenced a little bit by De Zerbi, which is fun. But yeah, I felt as though Man City were really good at just moving the Liverpool press around, making them really narrow and then exploiting the wide areas. So we saw Kevin De Bruyne and Gundogan on either side just dropping out in those build-up phases. And I think the first Man City goal, which was an exceptional goal, really, was De Bruyne playing the ball through down the wing to Mahrez, who then switched the play, and then it was just a perfect build-up goal where everything had to go right, and they got everything
turn
perfect.
From Gundogan, where he took it on his right, and then played it immediately. Left, yeah. And Grealish's square ball was perfect. To be fair, it's like he made it look easy, but that ball can very easily go wrong.
Was that the equaliser?
Yeah.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
The first goal that they scored. The Liverpool goal came from the fact that Man City were being really aggressive in their pressing, which is, I think, maybe an area where Liverpool fell down a little bit as well, because I think that when you're playing the way that Liverpool were playing with a 4-2-4 press and they were getting narrow, you then need your fullbacks to jump onto the wide players to make sure that you don't get any easy possession in those areas. Now, obviously, that's terrifying, and Liverpool have been struggling this season from having, you know, aggressive fullbacks who then get exploited by the opposition. And so it felt to me like they were hanging back a little bit, whereas Man City, if you look at some of the phases of the game, they've got John Stones, who's playing as an inverted fullback, just jumping onto the opposition fullback. And actually for the Liverpool goal, you see Stones jumping onto the fullback on one side, and then Aki jumping onto the fullback on the other, and they're just leaving two centre-backs and Rodri with four Liverpool attackers in front of them or around them. And so Trent Alexander-Arnold's just able to play that first time ball over the top and exploit that. And they tried to do that quite a bit in the first half, just getting behind the aggressive Man City press. But the reason why Pep does that is because it gives you a huge amount of upside. You can control the opposition mostly, and you're going to generate more chances yourself by turning the ball over than you are the opposition exploiting it by going in behind. So, yeah, I thought it was a really fun game. Man City just seem at that point of the season, right, where they go a goal down to Liverpool and it doesn't faze them. They just keep doing what they're doing. They dominate games. They'll occasionally give up goals here and there because of their aggressive style of play, but they're good enough to just score two or three more and make no difference to it. So, yeah, I thought it was a fun game.
Well, I also thought it was fun. I did a video on it after the match. You can see it on Tifo IRL, where I broke down the whole thing with all the tactics and stuff like that. And one of the things I think is interesting about games like this is that although these managers have almost total control over what's going on, except for the individual decisions that their players make at certain times. And like the first goal that Liverpool score, like City are doing everything right, I think. And there's just a little decision that Aki has to make whether to jump to go and make that attack. Because basically they play it from the back and goalkeeper goes to Fabinho, who manages to slip it into Alexander-Arnold, and they're just skipping past the press, which is dangerous, but it results in a goal. So that's the good thing to do. Aki, like you say, makes that decision to go and they get caught in the high line. But then the goal that I think the equaliser for City, I think it is.
In the first half, yeah.
It's the one where the ball comes round to De Bruyne. So they start the 4-4-2 press from Liverpool changes to more of the 3 because Jota comes round and it leaves a little bit of space for De Bruyne around the side. And he turns it on round to Mahrez in the wide right because they're keeping Grealish and Mahrez always super wide, like touching the touchline to stretch that back line. And then that's when Robertson makes the decision to jump. When he should probably, I don't know, what do you think? Do you think Robertson should have jumped there? I can't decide what he should have done.
Yeah, I think the reason why City use their fullback wide players really wide is precisely because they want to pin the opposition fullbacks, right? And they want to generate space in between the wide. With a 4, obviously with a 4-2-4 press, the space is going to be on either side of the midfield.
Yeah.
So as long as you can keep that area free, then you know roughly that if you're having any trouble with build-up, you can find those wide areas anyway. City were pretty good at finding those balls wide in pretty controlled areas as well. But interestingly, I think the narrowness was what did for Liverpool. So that was a really good example of why you want to be getting narrow in your build-up in the central space. I have an inverting fullback because it does pull those wide players in. And so what Liverpool were doing is they had the front four, they would have the two central players, so Gakpo and Salah, sitting on the pivot players, and usually Salah would jump onto the centre-back who was holding the ball. As soon as he did that, whichever side... It would be Gakpo or Salah jumping onto the centre back, and whoever went, then the wide player would jump in to cover the pivot player as well. But the problem then is you're leaving space in the wide areas as well, and the idea is that the fullback then jumps to cover that space. And I felt that the City were just really good at exploiting that. And if you watch that game back, just their pivots always end up finding space because they know exactly when to drop out, when to move into a shadow, but be ready for the bounce pass across. Very similar to the things that we see Brighton doing as well. And as a result of that, Liverpool's forward press just couldn't control anything. But I felt like that City just knew that they could drop out their two wide play, the shoot eights into the wide areas, and there would always be a free pass on.
Yeah.
And it was had really nice access to the Grealish and Mahrez as well in the wide areas. And so, yeah, I don't know what I would have done if I was Klopp. I think it's probably more of a case of the system or structure that he was using not working.
Well, I was going to ask you this. I wonder if you agree with what I took away from it was that I think City were deliberately trying to structure build up in such a way that they'd go to the right hand side of their right hand side to then be able to target like a ball over the top, through ball, wherever they want when you get further up the pitch. So maybe the final third or the halfway, you start to change the angle. Like in the past, like managers like Dean Smith at Villa said that they wouldn't, remember when Villa battered Liverpool, remember that game?
7-2.
7-2, yeah. Something like that. So like he said that what they notice is that they play, they're very narrow out of possession. So if you just switch the play, you want to switch the play constantly, that's what you do. But I think as other teams are doing, this is what I ask, is that what you think they're doing as well to then target Alexander-Arnold specifically?
I think
balls on the top, or he's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think it's Robertson and Alexander-Arnold, and I think that's because Liverpool are so reliant on their fullbacks in possession that they always just end up with the situational back three, and so we see that a lot. So if you can get the ball in, for some reason they seem to sit Trent Alexander-Arnold a lot deeper than Robertson at the moment. There's been so many goals this season where the opposition have targeted the space behind Robertson when he's gone forward. Van Dijk comes across, and then you've got basically Trent Alexander-Arnold becomes a second centre-back. And so if you can overload on that back post area, then you can have a lot of joy, I think.
That back three as well keeps being that the right side centre-back goes over to cover the space behind Trent Alexander-Arnold, and then you've got, so like Van Dijk is in the middle, obviously, then Robertson. But they don't compact the space. They leave it wide open. And I can't quite figure out why, because to me it looks like you have one centre-back at the times.
Rather than three.
It's so far split, and it's obviously a tactical decision to be made, and I can't make sense of it because it looks weak.
Yeah, and I think it looks weak because usually in those situations, the opposition will have their back line and one or two of the centre midfielders dropping into that line as well. So again, it's because Liverpool play so aggressively, they end up in these situations where they do leave themselves exposed to a certain extent. And the other thing that City were doing is they were abandoning the forward line a lot with Alvarez dropping in and creating space for those two wide players to get in from the outside as well. It was in hindsight, it is very Brighton under De Zerbi, this idea that you sort of do slow central build up. Create space in the wide areas to then be able to decompress really quickly at speed, get your centre forward pulling the opposition centre backs out and creating space for your wide players to get into. So yeah, I thought it was a fun game from that perspective.
And then that thing as well, I mean, if you were Klopp, say you're a big Premier League manager now and you can see these things happening and the City are getting a lot of joy in this. I mean, talk about Alvarez there, that little tactical bit, like he sets up one of the goals basically because he drops deep and then pings a ball over top for the player running in behind. I think it's Grealish when he scores his goal, and then De Bruyne runs into that exact space we're talking about. It's there. So he knows this is coming, but how do you protect that player and that? What's happening here? Are you breaking the studio?
Bottle fell out.
Oh, dear. Maybe that's a sign we need not to talk about this because we are going to defensive issues again once more. What problems do you see Liverpool having defensively? What do you think needs to change?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because every team does target a space behind Trent. And like for a long time, there's been discussions about, can he defend? Does it matter if he can't defend? And when they were good and everything clicked and Henderson and Fabinho had loads of energy, it didn't really matter because he created enough goals. And now they're not as potent in attack for all these various fatigue reasons and whatever. But he is being exploited so much that it's kind of becoming a problem that you can't ignore anymore. But then what's the solution? Because they don't have another right back in the squad. What are you going to do? Put James Milner there? He'll get burnt as well.
They have done it.
Yeah.
And he's such a good player. This is the eternal problem, is that I think any defender is going to be in trouble if they're always ganged up on 2v1.
Yeah, and if they're asked to attack like he is, that much.
But he attacks from a slightly deeper position now. Like, it is slightly deeper, and you'll try and... I think you see his touch map, it is deeper.
He's definitely deeper.
And I said in that video that I did, I'm pretty sure he stays in line with Henderson or Fabinho, one of the two. He just stays in line with him. So that's his reference point. And then...
Partly because Salah doesn't do as much tracking.
Well, it's the right side. And Harvey Elliott, I think, is learning how to defend at that level as well, especially in these high pressing situations, and maybe he isn't quite there.
Again, with Salah, like, you've got the situation where in possession Salah is dropping out onto the wide, into the wide area, because that's what he likes to pick up the ball up on the sideline and run in on the diagonal.
Yeah.
Out of possession, Salah's playing in the middle, and so so Harvey Elliott has to switch. Like, Harvey Elliott is basically just having to cover for Salah as well. So yeah, he was playing as the wide player in the front four, and Salah was going forward, so you can sort of offset Salah's lack of tracking back. So you have Harvey Elliott in that situation. It does feel as though Liverpool have gone from a situation where they were able to be dominant because they had all of these weaknesses that the system out of possession covered up.
Yeah.
And when you know that that's the case, you can be super confident going forward. I was watching the game back yesterday, and there's situations where Trent jumps forward onto the fullback to be in an aggressive press, but you can see him chicken out midway through, and he's like, "Oh, I'm going to go back." And I think that's what's doing for Liverpool at the moment, is that they don't have faith in their out of possession system, so that their in possession system is so much less aggressive because they're terrified of giving the ball away and then being countered on. So it's like both sides of the game negatively affected by the fact that they're less aggressive going forward, but they're also less aggressive out of possession. And so what's ended up is a sort of midpoint between the two, and it's a mess, really.
You can't half-ass an aggressive press, can you?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's I wonder if a bit of it is that a lot of teams have figured out this group of players rather than just specifically the tactical system he's using. Like, they just sort of know what's going to... They're so used to it now. But then, like Klopp said, in his post-match, he was saying how there are decisions they were making and things they were doing that they just cannot be doing. Like, they'll be trying to get that coached out of them. And so whatever reason it's happening. But City were amazing. And Guardiola said, I think it's either the best or one of the best performances he's seen in 7 years. I thought they were absolutely superb.
I love Jack Grealish.
Yeah, we should talk about Jack Grealish, because he's great.
He was amazing.
And he's quietly put together like an incredible season. Like, we went from last season where everyone... I mean, the beginning of this season, I made a video as like why Jack Grealish is perfect for Pep Guardiola, and it was a controversial topic at that time. And I feel as though we've now gone from the situation where people are like, 100 million, but you can't even get onto their starting 11, to him being one of the first names on the team sheet. But and then,
like with all City wingers, it was going to take him a year to learn the role, right? Because at Villa, it was like hero missions, I'll save the day, I'll dribble wherever I want.
And the whole system was built around him.
Yeah, and he's admitted as much in interviews. He's like, I didn't realise it was going to have to take in this much information and learn so many new things. And now he's kind of understands his role. And he also probably benefits from not having João Cancelo behind him brilliant player, but always trying to do the same things in the same spaces, like right footers who cut inside and whatever. So yeah, he's just learned his role.
There's a moment in the first half before City equalise where I think Stones heads the ball, loses the ball in transition, and Grealish bombs it back about 60 yards to make a block on
Salah's pass. And then he scores and then he assists Alvarez equaliser a minute later.
Yeah, at the other end. Yeah, and I think that was sort of emblematic of just how far he's come on. There were so many situations in that game where he is doing defensive work really deep on the left-hand side as well. And just a brilliant, brilliant player.
Steve's written it in, so I'm going to ask it, right? But City basically have two different teams, like one with Haaland in it because they play in a certain way to get the maximum out of him, and another when Alvarez plays, because then you can do the things he was doing, like leading the press, which Haaland also does, to be fair. But then like that goal that Grealish scores where Alvarez drops in to play over the top is the kind of thing I haven't seen Haaland do. So do we dare discuss whether one is better than the other? It's a silly argument, isn't it? Or is it?
I've seen people argue that in the league, City should play this way with Alvarez, and in the Champions League, they should play with
Well, this worked against Liverpool, particularly with Alvarez, I think. Like, would it have been different with Haaland in the team?
Yeah, it definitely would have been different, I think. I think the fact that you can expose Liverpool on the break means that having a player who can drop in to make that front, the back line of Liverpool even weaker is going to be a dangerous approach. I still think that Haaland would probably, they would have been fine with Haaland in this
game. He'd probably scored seven in this game, yeah.
I mean, who knows?
They'd have just been different types of goals, wouldn't they?
I think.
Or somebody else would do, like, it sounds...
He's fucking amazing. It's ridiculous. Like, they scored loads of goals with him. He's scored like 80 already.
It's just maybe doesn't quite look as fluid when he plays, but goal's a goal and he scores loads of them.
It's definitely more one-dimensional when Haaland plays up front. But you know, the downside of being one-dimensional is that you have the best goal scorer who's ever lived playing.
But it's a great dimension.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it the best dimension?
It works, right? But I think this is why people are suggesting in the league you might want to have a little bit more fluidity, because, you know, in league games, you're not really required to have just a guy who's going to bully goals necessarily. Sometimes it might be good to actually have some kind of sustainability to the way that you're attacking. But whereas in a knockout competition, it's you know, we've seen it with Real Madrid over and over again. Just having someone who is going to score goals is such a dangerous weapon. So I see the arguments, but it's hard to argue, isn't it? When the guy is just scoring so many goals. There's some games where City look like they're struggling a little bit, right? And sure, like change things up. But then you get these other games where he scores five goals, six goals in a game, and you're like, well.
Are you calling him a flat track bully?
But I don't think
we've normalised how exceptional
he is. He is a flat track bully in many respects, but there's going to be some teams where that's good and bad against. And I think the idea is, like, why not use him that in mind, right?
It's just a nice problem to have, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there are many problems to be had in the top four race, because then you've got Arsenal and Man City obviously competing for that title race. And you see by this Man City performance that they're very much in that. But Liverpool are now below Brentford in the league. Steve's dying in the control room, if you heard that. So Liverpool are now below Brentford in 42 points. So Brentford's 43. Brighton and Brentford shared a lovely 3-3 draw, John. One of the two well-run clubs, the well-run clubs derby. Yeah.
It wasn't that lovely, was it? It was quite spicy, I heard.
Well,
I didn't actually catch this. I am going to catch it at some point this week, but I saw that Brighton put up 4.5 XG, so they were clearly playing well. I think that Brentford were really efficient, so they scored a couple of set-piece goals, which is always good to see.
Tony's finish was nice, as was Mitoma's.
Hmm.
That's my contribution to this analysis.
This is excellent.
And I don't want Brighton to get into the Champions League, but I fear they will.
Why don't you want them to get into the Champions League?
Because they are my club's arch rivals. But
everyone knows the time old.
They're like 100 miles away, aren't they?
Yes.
This is a nonsense derby, and I'm sure lots of people love it. But what is it then?
It's a rivalry.
It's a rivalry.
Based on history, not geography.
Oh, okay. Well, then I like it again.
Do you have a
If there isn't, there should be a TIFO video explaining it. Like, there probably
I think
is.
There is, yeah. And do you have a geographical rivalry? Is that Millwall,
Charlton? But they're so far down the pyramid.
Who is your geographical rival, John?
Right now,
is it Henry?
It's you. It will be Henry later when I'm in closer proximity to him. But
Henry is John's flatmate. Yeah,
you made that really ambiguous then.
I don't know. Is that what you call it, flatmate?
Yeah.
We share a flat together.
We share a flat, yeah. That's what you do.
But no, they probably won't, will they? It will be Newcastle and either Man United or Tottenham.
Yes. Yeah,
but they're still... It's
trying
still
to get us back
enough,
on track
here.
Yeah,
that was good.
I'm trying to take us off. Brighton, we should stay on them. They are in a really good position to potentially qualify for the Champions League, much to Ruben's dissatisfaction. But have we...
His geographical dissatisfaction. Yeah. Not his... What was the other thing?
Historical.
Historical, yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Who are your geographical enemies? It's funny.
Right now.
The idea of having an enemy is quite funny, isn't it? Like, you have an enemy.
I have many enemies.
Do you?
Yeah. I can't reveal them on this public space. Okay. I harbour them.
I think I know where I can find them.
I'll tell you later.
All right. Brighton, are they better under De Zerbi?
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely flying right now under De Zerbi.
Does he deserve me more attention?
I will love it and I think I deserve it. What's that? I think, I mean, he's been the nerd's favourite for a long time, right? He started out at Benevento, I think, and they got relegated and he ended up at Sassuolo. But when he was at Sassuolo, everyone started watching him, getting excited about him, and then went across to Shakhtar Donetsk and sort of disappeared from the limelight a little bit. And then obviously the war in Ukraine happened and... Yeah, he came back to the top five leagues, and I think has maybe surprised people with how quickly his ideas have been bought into by Brighton. I suppose in many respects, Graham Potter laid the foundations for, you know, flexibility meant that De Zerbi could come in and have an impact. I guess I'm interested to see the long term effect of how teams respond to De Zerbi, because one of the things that we've seen happening this season, I think, is you get sort of half season, if you're playing well, then teams start changing the way that they're approaching you. So with Arsenal, for example, I did a video on their defensive numbers changing after the World Cup, and I think a lot of that's come down to the fact that teams recognise that Arsenal are going to batter you if you do anything other than sit deep. And so teams are now sitting deep, which changes the way that the dynamics of the game go. And so Arsenal can be a little bit more open from defensive transition, but that's because they're controlling games and forcing the opposition back. Newcastle were sort of wobbly a bit, weren't they, in the second half of the season. Teams started sitting deeper against them and it became about how they're going to break teams down. And I think that with Brighton, because I think they play in such a unique way, right? We've talked about Man City playing in this way, but doing this really patient build-up, baiting the opposition in, and then being able to generate space then where you can transition into. So usually with transition, you're doing that by giving the opposition the ball, sitting deep, and then hoping you turn it over and being able to break. Whereas what De Zerbi's trying to do is create those same conditions through build-up play. So building up deep, baiting the opposition in, and then playing these really quick combinations that get the ball down the field, and then... Doing that abandonment of the front line, so getting your two strikers dropping quite deep, pulling the centre backs out, and then creating space for your two wide players to run into, being able to find them through these patterns. It's really exciting. But I'm sure that, you know, when it comes to the summer, all of the analysts at the various Premier League clubs will sit down and be like, right, what's the best way of trying to cause problems? What are their weaknesses? And it'll be interesting to see how they weather those storms. But even now, right, there's different teams trying to find ways of stopping them in their build-up phase, and there is a load of flexibility in their build-up. So, for example, Leeds were quite interesting. They basically were really narrow. They did a 4-2-4 press against them, so they had a front four around the double pivot, and they were just they were not jumping in onto the centre backs at all. They were like happy to let Brighton centre backs hold the ball, and Brighton just got to a point where they're like, well, there's no point having two double pivots with like four Leeds players around them, so we'll just go to a single pivot and move the other player out. And so they definitely have solutions already in their build up phase, but I am interested to see like what happens when teams figure them out. Can you figure them out? Can Brighton be figured out?
Well, Brentford almost did, because they were leading until the very last minute. It was a penalty, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, McAllister scored a penalty. And on Brentford, like, they're seventh. They should not be seventh.
It's mental, isn't it?
It's crazy. What do you think? Like, what do you think of Brighton here? Like, where do they get to? Where does this stop?
Brentford or Brighton?
Brentford.
Do you consider them to be a rival, either geographically or historically?
I mean, they are closer to us than
They've
Brighton.
They've got the same first letter as well. Does that come into it?
The Brewer Derby. No, I don't mind Brentford. They're very admirable. I mean, from a fan perspective, I'm just very envious of both clubs. But, like, realistically, this is probably the ceiling for both of them, right? Because of just how much money the teams above them have to spend, and the fact that Chelsea and Liverpool will eventually be good again. But they should enjoy it while it lasts, because they've got a nice team, a nice stadium, and they play good football. And, like, I just, so jealous of them having like Ivan Toney. If you put Ivan Toney in like in the Palace team, we'd be infinitely better. Yeah, it's just I don't like how good they are. I'm happy for them.
It's an interesting question though, isn't it? Like, do we think that Brighton and Brentford could break into the top whatever number we're calling
when it
now?
Becomes the big eight?
Yeah,
but probably only when other teams now, have a it? Disastrous season.
Yeah,
like, you need other ones like Liverpool, Everton, and Chelsea. Yeah.
But I feel we've seen teams do it before,
Yeah.
Right? We've seen Leicester do it. They're a good example where they had a good season and they rode that for a few seasons and then dropped off. But given that Brentford and Brighton are always held up as being like smart clubs, do we think that they can do it sustainably? Because I think that's the thing, right? If they can sustainably be, you know, challenging for the top four, then they become de facto part of the top six, do they not? Isn't that, I mean, that's exactly what the teams who, like Chelsea and Liverpool aren't going to be challenging for the top four this season, but we still consider them to be in the top six. But that's because they've got lots of money. I mean, Liverpool are smart as well, but like, do we think that Brighton and Brentford can make up for the lack of financial clout, or even maybe end up having financial clout because they are run by smart people?
No. Palace and Brighton's geographical rivalry.
It's not geographical.
No, but this is a thing, okay. Right? There is actually only 45 miles between the Amex and Selhurst Park.
Yeah.
That would take 4 hours and 50 minutes to cycle. Well, it's a fast yard.
A lot of people do cycle it.
Yeah, and 14 hours to walk.
Yeah.
Which, sometimes I want to go on a long walk, but that is too far.
Along the M23.
Yeah. Walking along the M23.
Interestingly, like, Leeds' biggest rivalry is with Manchester United.
Yeah.
And I would consider that to be a derby. Maybe I wouldn't.
Well, this
but
is the thing.
It's 51
right?
miles, so it's actually further away than.
Also, it is 45 miles to the Amex. I was going to say the Amex isn't in Brighton; it's in Falmer, which is a horrible little place with a very small train station.
Well, it's near Brighton to me.
Yeah.
So 45 miles, and then you've got Brighton's South Coast rival Southampton are 68 miles away from the Amex. Hmm. So
actually, this isn't as the crow flies. Let me work that one out.
As the crow flies.
My favourite South Coast derby is, rivalry, is Plymouth Argyle and Portsmouth have a bit of beef from many league encounters and playoff encounters and players going from one club to the other or whatever. And Argyle fans like to sing "You Dirty Northern Bastards" at the Portsmouth fans because of their relative geography, despite them both being on the South Coast.
Oh, I see.
I like that pettiness.
The air distance from Elland Road to Old Trafford is actually only 37 miles, so I apologise. But it's 50 miles if you drive.
If you're a crow that goes to the football.
Yeah, if you're a really drunk crow,
yeah,
it's much longer.
Would they let a crow in?
I think they can get free admission, can't they?
Bear with me now, right? If a crow took on the mind of a human, right? So it was really smart, this crow, and it was walking.
Have you nicked this from Game of Thrones?
No, but if it was walking on its hind legs and everything, and it's just wearing a jacket,
that's
right?
That's what they do that.
So
they walk on their hind legs.
Five crows on each other's shoulders.
Okay.
Would you let them into the game? Like, if it comes in and it has a ticket, you'd let it in.
Yeah, most grounds are ticketed anyway, right? With automatic ticketing, so
that was
it's all e-tickets now, though. How are they going to carry a smartphone?
Doesn't say people only, does it?
It's much easier for them to just fly over the top, though, JJ.
And they should just do that. They can see all the games for free.
I was watching Charlton back this week, and I don't know if you've ever watched Charlton recently, but they have a flock of pigeons which frequents their pitch in almost every game, and the pigeons move around. And you're like, oh, they're going to run into the pigeons, and the pigeons fly to the other end of the pitch. And then like 2 minutes later, when the other team transitions to the other end, they're like, oh, there's the pigeons.
That do you know what, Aberdeen, there's a hawk that they take out because there's so many seagulls, so many of them. Oh, and they're so aggressive at certain times of the year. When they have like baby seagulls, obviously adult ones have baby ones, the mothers are very protective and they will swoop. I've seen a seagull take an entire pie out of someone's hand once. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen, really. He was
in the
like,
stadium? Or was
no, no, just walking around near Union Street, the main street in Aberdeen, and there's a guy had a pie like in the bag, you know, you have it in the bag, and he had the pie and he was about to take a bite, as you would, like that. And as he did that... I swear.
You saw that live in the flesh.
I saw it. It was so funny. Know. Anyway, but they have a hawk to get rid of them. Mm. And it works.
They have an eagle.
We don't anymore.
I saw that eagle.
Kayla.
I don't know what it was called.
Was called Kayla. May she rest in peace.
This was back in, I don't know when. It was when you were in the Championship. I went to Selhurst Park for a game against Leicester. Leicester had Chris Wood playing. And Jamie Vardy and Harry Kane were on the bench for them.
12-13 promotion season, yeah.
There you go.
Mad.
That's what it was. So there was an eagle back then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we had an eagle fly about before games from crossbar to crossbar until 2020 when that eagle died.
We didn't get a new eagle.
No, we didn't get a new eagle.
Budgetary
disrespectful to Kayla. We cannot replace her, you know, as Pep would say. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun, though. And now we just have, like, storms.
Child labour and eagles. Like, that's what's wrong with this country.
Yeah. Well, on that sad note, I think we should think of the eagle during this next break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
And we're back! Newcastle United 2, Manchester United, Electric Boogaloo. They were really well beaten by Newcastle here. Erik ten Hag kind of laid into his players and said the equivalent of the Newcastle wanted it more, had more passion. But like we were talking about earlier, about Newcastle and how they play and how people have adapted to them. They just run at you. They just go, 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 and you can't handle it.
It's like peak Klopp's Liverpool in the early days, isn't it?
We've been saying this,
shape,
yeah.
Like, sorry, go on. You were about to speak before I jumped
no,
in.
No, no, no. You keep going. Okay.
Well, and they prevented United from... Not that United are particularly good at it because, you know, De Gea and... I love Varane, but you know what I mean? He's not quite John Stones with the ball. It's every time De Gea would pass the ball out to Martinez... They all looked kind of just shocked into paralysis. And, when you've got like Jacob Murphy and Isak just running at you, like United were just frozen and basically couldn't play through them at all.
Well, did you see Alan Shearer did a bit of, I think it was Shearer, it might have been Danny Murphy, did an analysis on Match of the Day 2 on Sunday night. And they pointed out, like, we know De Gea is not very good at playing out from the back or doesn't trust himself to do it. And so they were setting up a lot of times in this game to play out from the back and then he was just launching it. And Varane, you can see, is getting frustrated with them because they've been told to try and do this, but Newcastle are pressing so high that narrow three to stop them doing it. This is not on our list of things to talk about, but De Gea is a thing that they're going to have to deal with at some point.
Yeah, it was announced this week that they're trying to renew, or he has renewed, that there's certainly a long way towards renewing.
Is it going to be on reduced wages?
Yeah, so the big question, I think, is whether or not they're going to bring in a starting keeper and keep him as a backup keeper. But if they're still playing De Gea next season, I can't see them having a better season than they've had this season.
Yeah. I think we should explain like why this exactly why this works, because it's to do with like having an extra player in build-up, right? So then a lot of teams will use the goalkeeper as an extra player. So... if you have 11 players, the goalkeeper is one of them. He can help, obviously, play it from the back, but it means you can play under pressure and play through presses, is one of the reasons why. And with like that's the thing Ten Hag wants to do, right?
Yeah, and they're struggling with ball progression anyway at the moment, Manchester United. So it's worth saying that we're not just singling out David De Gea.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Varane. I don't think Varane is particularly good under a huge amount of pressure in build-up, for example. And a lot of teams like to try and funnel their presses so that the ball ends up with him. And again, at the moment, Manchester United have lost Christian Eriksen, which I think is really affecting their progression through the middle as well. But it seems to be the case that in certain games against certain teams, Erik ten Hag wants his team to try and build up from the back. And we saw the Leeds United game. So there's two Leeds games in a row because there was a cancellation. So they ended up playing us twice in the league. In both of those games, Ten Hag was trying to get his team to build up through the Leeds press. And obviously Leeds are good at pressing, and they really struggled in both of those games to get anything out of it. And I think this is a problem, because when you're a team like Manchester United, you need to be able to repeatedly move the ball down the field, progress the ball into areas where you can then generate chances. Like, it's not rocket science, and they're not able to do that at the moment. And that starts with, as you say, David De Gea. He's important because every build-up from the back is going to start with your keeper pretty much every time. And so, yeah, if your keeper isn't on it, then it holds you back massively.
I think we see that specifically in this game, because De Gea's launching it, and then what you've got is a midfield two. Is it McTominay and Casemiro are playing as the...
What, against Newcastle?
Yeah.
No, Casemiro wasn't playing. Sabitzer
and Bruno. And that's McTominay what I meant. Started ahead of them.
Yeah, I meant to say it was McTominay and Sabitzer, because they're missing Casemiro and Eriksen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with those two players missing, it changes the entire way it functions. And you can see there was a split between... Like, Bruno Fernandes was often dropping deep to try and be a link player.
They were using him to try and progress the ball, yeah, and keeping McTominay forward.
And the shape was all wrong.
Eric Ten Hag had watched Scotland play in the international.
And thought, he's Frank Lampard now. We'll play him up there.
He's breaking from deep in that Scotland game. He's still,
Box arriving,
yeah. It's the thing. So, like, you can see the difference that having those players like Casemiro and Eriksen has made enormously, even from that very first phase of build-up play. It changes everything they're kind of doing there. And without them, they're a different team. And it makes De Gea look worse, it makes Varane look worse, but they don't have those players there. But with De Gea, you can't play the way you want to anyway. But then United now, we should talk about Newcastle in a bit, but just stay on United for a second. They haven't won or scored a goal in their last three Premier League games. And basically, since they won the League Cup, they haven't been quite the same team.
They were sketchy in that game. I remember getting panned for saying it, but we saw much of the same problems that they had in that game in this game as well. And they've really sort of plummeted a little bit recently. So,
do you feel you've got redemption now?
No, I don't. But I do feel as though it's become very obvious why I was saying that. I feel as though it's a long way for Man United to go still, because they lose a couple of key players and they have these problems anyway in build-up. And suddenly they go from being a team where you feel as though they're going to win all of their games to a team where you can't see where their next win's coming from. And I think a lot of that, again, is to do with when you are a team at the elite level, you need to be able to control games in different ways. And I feel as though Manchester United just don't have the ability to do that at the moment. It'll be a busy summer for them, because they are going to have to bring in players who can improve the floor of players that they have. But at the moment, they're looking like they could easily drop out of the top four, even when we were talking about title races like not a month ago. So it happened really quickly, didn't it?
Yeah.
On De Gea, did you see this interview that popped up from Bastian Schweinsteiger? Who, remember when he played for Man United? That was disappointing. He said that David De Gea went up to him in training and said, "Am I better than Manuel Neuer?" And Bastian Schweinsteiger just said, "No, obviously not." And then every time he had a good game, he'd go over to him and say, "What about now? Am I better than Manuel Neuer?" And he'd say, "Still no, obviously." And he was right. It's brutal, but it's
true. Just wants love as well. We all need love. De Gea's not signed a new contract yet, apparently, but blah, 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 blah. Newcastle, they're so good sometimes. Like, when they play like this, it's really good. And a lot of it's tactical, but honestly, I think some of it is just kind of energy, passion.
Hashtag passion. The atmosphere was so loud when even on the TV, you could tell, like, they're really up for this, partly because of who they're playing against. And they had that little dip, didn't they, where they kind of became a little bit less cutting edge in attack. And a slightly leakier, and now they seem to be back to their best, where they have that back five that you did that video about. When they play, they're really solid. But even like they were missing Joe Linton, like Almiron wasn't starting, but they just seemed really up for it. And now they've got a fit Isak up front, and he's just lovely, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a great player.
I think, again, with Newcastle, it's very much a tactical fit thing, where there's going to be certain teams that are going to try and build up from the back, and it really suits them for because they know that they can press them. Whereas I think what we're seeing, the games where they're struggling, is when teams are like, "We're not even going to bother trying to build through you. We'll just go long and we take out a big part of your actual goal creation strategy." So yeah, I think a game against Manchester United trying to build up but not particularly good at it is like the perfect conditions for them. So I think Isak was just incredible. Just everything that you want from a striker in that kind of system, like out of possession, really, really good. Ran the whole game, didn't stop running the whole time. Smart pressing, forcing the opposition into wide areas. But then his hold up play, incredible. Looked really dangerous as well as a goal threat, and was fundamental in that first goal as well. So yeah, really, really nice player, and it's nice to see him doing well, because I think people were a little bit like, oh, you know, foreign players come in and not done that well, but it's great to see.
I really enjoy watching Anthony play against Dan Byrne.
Well, I was going to point this
it's
out.
It's like that Valbuena Fellaini.
Yeah. United kept going long, like we were talking about a minute ago. And Newcastle, like their squad, their recruitment, the way they've built these players, they've got big lads. Like, they're really physically imposing. And so Anthony's never winning a header against Dan Byrne. And Ten Hag was saying, like before I said, that the teams did not perform the way it should. They didn't want it as much. They weren't determined. And I think you saw it in Newcastle's speed of thought and actual speed of play. They were just going, like full on acceleration to 100 miles an hour from go. But when the ball went long, they were competing for everything, knowing they were going to win. They kind of bullied them a little bit. And United don't have those kind of players. They have what you might think are better technical players, but that's not enough to really win.
It was interesting that Ten Hag went with Weghorst up front and then McTominay behind him, because it felt as though they were going to try and be quite aggressive out of possession as well. I feel as though that option is usually Weghorst drops back and Rashford plays on the line of the last man, whereas it felt as though he wanted extra physicality in the middle with those two players.
He's played McTominay there a couple of times now in that sort of, not 10 role, but yeah.
Yeah, like the more advanced eight.
Rushing one. In, yeah.
Yeah, where you get him out of the way for the build-up and then...
Yeah, because that's not his strongest point, is it? But he's kind of been unfairly placed there and therefore got a lot of stick, McTominay. When he plays really deep and they're kind of asking him to be like a build-up number six kind of guy, and he's just doesn't quite...
He's not that kind of player. I think he gets... McTominay's a funny one. Like, he's played centre-back for Scotland quite a lot as well, but he's not a centre-back either. I don't know what...
But the reason he was quite good in that back three now is because he could progress the ball through that right channel.
By carrying it, yeah. Like, there's so many times I've seen him play for Scotland that... Not so many, but there's a lot of times he played for there where you can see just split decisions that he's not quite sure about, and it has a real effect, like a knock-on effect to other people in that team. It doesn't work there.
He's like an old-fashioned box-to-box number eight in a 4-4-2 kind of, isn't he? Like, he just kind of, maybe he's playing 15 years too late, or maybe he just needs to play for a slightly worse club. Like, I think the fact that he plays for Manchester United is like, people expect him to, like, the base level of good is a lot higher. So if he played for, I don't know, at West Ham next to Rice, everyone would be like, pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, Mourinho loved him, didn't he, when he was there?
Mourinho used him as a political pawn to say, I need more players. When that was the reason he got brought into the team, IMO.
Interesting. Oh, I like it. Saucy! Don't know why I said that either. I'm having a weird day. Seagulls can eat up to 20% of its body weight in food each day. So...
They love chips.
Depends how heavy the pie was, I suppose. Did they eat the whole thing? I don't know. Gulls can detect food from over 3 miles away. That's good.
How? They just sit there and like, someone's eating a pie 3 miles away.
Well, they can see it on GPS. They can see where the shops are. And so they can get some crisps.
They have an app.
Seagulls.
They just spread the word. They're like Brighton Beach, just constantly.
Yeah, they share it.
I mean, I know that the supermarket in Tooting has got food in it. That doesn't mean I can detect food from over 8 miles away, does it?
It doesn't say they can detect good food. Because like, I wish I had that power right now where we work, because there's not many great places to eat around here. It doesn't matter anyway. Seagulls have excellent memories. They can remember specific people's faces and places where food has been hidden
from
days ago.
Seem to be very food-centric.
Yeah,
seagulls,
they like food.
Seagulls imagine having the ability to like sit in this room and be like, oh, I know there's a Mars bar exactly there in the other room. That must be a weird feeling. Would you be aware of all of the food around you for 3 miles?
Like
that's a lot of food.
It's not like a magical sense. It's just smell, no? It's yeah, but like a dog.
There's a lot.
I mean, it's
smell.
A long distance. Don't get me wrong.
A three-mile radius around you. Yeah, that's a lot of food.
Yeah.
Do they just like there's loads of food everywhere?
Too much variety.
Surely
just,
they
like,
can't smell
in
all
different
of that food.
Like,
yeah.
Do I want a kebab or that pie? You know, don't know.
They also seem to love like takeaway food, don't they?
That's because that's what they can steal from people in the street.
Yeah, but if they had a choice, what would they choose? The healthy vegan option or the pie.
Yeah, they love vegan sausage rolls from Greg's.
This is the kind of video content that we should be trying to see what seagulls would prefer to eat if they had the choice.
So just go. We should go out down the road and just stand with various food products in our hands and see which ones go first.
Yeah, see what the seagull takes first.
Is there many seagulls in London? I don't see many.
You need,
do you reckon it would work with pigeons? Do pigeons have great food sense?
AC Milan versus Napoli in the quarter-final preview of the Champions League, is it? They're playing each other? So Napoli have been absolutely brilliant this season, but they got battered 4-0 by AC Milan, John.
Yeah, they did. And we've been talking about how this is actually an interesting matchup because Milan seem to play really well against Napoli every time they face them. For various reasons. I mean, AC Milan are very much a team who are about out of possession play and causing teams problems in build up, and that's what they did so well in this game. They put Napoli under a huge amount of pressure when they've got players like Sandro Tonali and Ismail Benacer in their central midfield. Those two are really, really good out of possession players, and I'm getting really put off by Steve writing Bayer Dromtumft on the
Steve has written John Haswas Bayer Dromtumft, but we're at 1 hour. Yeah.
But basically, yeah, this was Milan sitting deep, causing problems for Napoli in their build-up, and then having the ability to get Rafael Leao into dangerous situations in transition. And Rafael Leao is just a massive big game player in these situations. He causes problems for teams, and that is why he is being so highly thought about across the transfer market.
Another manager highly thought of is Thomas Tuchel, who took charge of Bayern Munich, and they this is the thing with this league, right? Like, I've done a video on Borussia Dortmund recently.
Here we go.
And I was like, this could be a really good game. And they're 1-0 up in a minute. Well, you know,
through a
horrendous own goal.
Oh, that was hilarious.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's the poor goalkeeper just completely swings at the ball and misses it.
If you're Leroy Sané in that situation, do you whack the ball into net or let
I thought about this a lot, and
I think he was going to, and then thought, on the off chance I'm off, I'm going to leave it.
I thought it was a smart play.
Yeah. The score was Bayern 4, Borussia Dortmund 2, so that means Bayern have won the league again.
It was given as an own goal. Did the keeper like
must have clipped his boot?
But even still, like, if it, I've always thought it was on target, and then
it was a centre back passed out, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Upamecano. He just basically played a through ball to Zane, and
that's harsh. Even if he's clipped it a little bit, it shouldn't count as no.
If it's on target,
And that seemed to cause them a bit of a head loss. Because obviously it's a massive game when you're top of the league.
Their heads came off.
Their heads very much came off. They gave away a couple of goals in fairly quick succession after that, and it was a shame really, because I think I always want to go into these games thinking, oh, let's have a really tight tactical affair and have a narrow win, but 3-0 by half time, 4-0 soon after half time.
A couple of extremely Thomas Müller goals as well.
Yeah,
the Müllerist of goals you've ever seen.
One where he sort of like
he just like kind of thighed it in there at the back post, and then just kind of stood there and went.
Well, was there? We've talked an awful lot, but is there a difference you saw straight away in what Tuchel's doing at Bayern compared to what Nagelsmann was doing?
I mean, it wasn't a huge difference for me. I think it was a very solid sort of 4-2-3-1. I think it was smart in that it was out of possession. I felt like it was a very basic press, but it was. It was basically a 4-4-2 out of possession press, but with certain buffers in the central space, because I think Dortmund are very good in terms of flexibility in the central space. They're dropping Emre Can, who's nominally a defensive midfielder, into the back line to make a three, pushing their wide players up, and then there's a lot of fluidity with Jude Bellingham. They played Rafael Guerrero in the centre as well, but then you've got Julian Brandt, who's just like floating around. You've got Marco Reus as well. Again, another player who's quite flexible. So I think that in Tuchel's head, it was like, let's do a basic press, but let's have certain safety valves, I guess you might call them, to make sure that they can't just overload us in the middle. So it was just basic football, but then largely what you would expect from Bayern. It was quite like Hansi Flick's Bayern, which is what Julian Nagelsmann did last season and then moved away from it this season. So I think it was just a case of go back to basics, make sure that you're not going to roll over and rely on the fact you've probably got the better players at the end of the day, and it worked out for him.
Is it interesting that he didn't start Musiala, because obviously he switched to a back four, so they're playing one more defender and he was the more attacking player to drop out for Pavard, I suppose?
Yeah, I don't know the ins and outs of the selection process, but I wonder why that was the case.
Maybe because Kimmich and Goretzka work really well as a pair, and Müller is Thomas Müller.
But he went with
there's no space for
him. He went with Koeman and Sané as well, who are sort of more wingery wingers than maybe Nagelsmann would have gone for. And I think once you do that, you're probably not going to play Musiala as a 10 behind Thomas Müller. So, but they went with Choupo-Moting as well. So for me, it was just sort of like he wanted to just have a solid 4-2-3-1 shape. Basic stuff. And I know that Kimmich came out afterwards and said this win was as much about what Julian Nagelsmann did for us as what Thomas Tuchel did for us as well. But I also don't think we're going to see much of what Thomas Tuchel actually wants this team to look like for a few weeks anyway. Especially this game was just be solid, rely on the fact you've got elite players, and you know, fortunately for them, it was sort of handed to them on a plate, really. So
it feels like a placeholder system a little bit, doesn't it? Yeah. It's like, you all know how to play this shape. You're all good. You all fit in these round pegs and round holes. Off you go.
They've all played in a 4-2-3-1 before.
It's the Bayern way. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. And a nice way to round up everything is if you think about what Tuchel's done there and played a shape that absolutely suits some of their best players to get more out of them in a huge game compared to what Graham Potter has been doing at Chelsea and just trying to mishmash them all together in a thing that he wants to do, which isn't quite really clear, not really a holding thing. Was he trying to hold it all together? Don't know what he was doing. It's done now, but Tuchel lives on and shall fight for the Bundesliga title this year, every year that he stays.
Fight.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, stroll. You'll get some angry emails.
Okay,
well,
fine.
But they'll be in German, so it's fine. And so I think that's probably enough for us. We've talked about all the football. It's all done. We should say goodbye.
Time.
Please say goodbye, Ruben.
Goodbye.
Please say goodbye, John.
Goodbye, John. Way!
That's good. I like that. Well, thank you to producer Steve and producer Don.
You're welcome.
But also, thanks to you, because you have listened to this podcast. Maybe you're new. If you are, that's great. If you're old, also fine. What do you prefer, John?
Well, there's pros and cons to both. I quite enjoyed being...
Do you like our loyal fan base, or do you only want growth?
The legacy fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're listening.
I feel on the spot here.
We love all the viewers and listeners equally.
I hate all of the viewers and listeners
equally. What about the evil ones? Some of our listeners...
Ruben loves the evil
...will
ones,
be evil.
Yeah.
Where'd you get that from?
You just said it. You love all of them.
Ah, that's true. Yeah, I don't think any of them are evil. So.
Oh, right. Okay. Good save.
Well, they were
good
nice save. To me last time, and I hope they're nice to me this time.
Yeah, be nice to Ruben. You can be mean about me. Everyone is, but be nice to Ruben.
That's so sad. Next week, Joe will be here, and the pod will come out a day later because it's Easter, and that means, as I understand it, a giant magical rabbit will
pop out of a sack.
Yeah, come out the sack and won't let us into the office that day. So that's there. I don't know if that's evil either, but that's what we've got. So thank you, listeners and viewers. Goodbye.
The Athletic.